Welcome to Phantom Astronaut. I'd like to thank all of the Phantom Astronaut patrons for supporting the show. If you enjoy the podcast and would like to support the show, visit phantomastronaut.com for all the different ways that you can help us continue to create. Today, I'm joined by Aaron Ross Powell, former director and editor of the Cato Institute's libertarianism.org, host of the Reimagining Liberty podcast, and contributor to The Unpopulist. Thanks for joining me today, Aaron. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So there's a saying that I have, which goes, "The Lord gives his hottest takes to the dunningest of Krugers." And I think that's kind of relevant to some stuff I want to get into with you today, because we've been talking back and forth on Threads a little bit. And I saw this great post from you about the nature of online discourse. But before we get into that, why don't you give the audience a little bit of a summary of kind of who you are and where you're situated politically, in case people don't know?
Sure. So I spent the first 13 years of my career working at the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank in Washington, D.C. And while there, I founded and headed a project called libertarianism.org, which kind of gives away the answer to your question about my political views, that was about the philosophy of libertarianism, the intellectual history, kind of the ideas side of it versus the nitty-gritty public policy side of it. I also hosted 450 episodes of a podcast called Free Thoughts, which was explorations of the ideas that informed political questions and political debate and political culture. I since have left, and my work has turned more towards trying to understand political culture, largely critiquing the culture and ideology of the far right, which I have, you know, over the years that I have been in this business has become a larger and larger threat. But doing that through thinking philosophically about these issues, and then also trying to understand not just which ideas are motivating political opinions, the sides, the debates, but also we might call like the sociology of this, like how these ideas get used, how they get misused, the ways that they're applied strategically, and how this interfaces with the broader culture of our politics, which seems very broken right now. And so trying to just kind of figure out what's going on from this more philosophical and cultural analysis perspective, as opposed to, you know, horse race politics that we get in a lot of the media.
Mm. I think that's probably the only way that we're going to be able to effectively approach at least the next decade or more in American politics. I don't know how much more utility, especially here in election year, we're going to see this play out, but I don't know how much more utility we're going to get from, I don't want to say partisan politics, so I'll use your terminology, horse race politics, team sports, tribalism, whatever you want to call it. You know, I saw this great video the other day, and I don't want to go too much into the current, you know, who's doing what, but it was a video. It was one of these sort of like quasi prank gotcha videos about a Trump supporter, and they were baiting them with like quotes that Trump had said, and they were attributing them to Biden and getting their reaction. And then they were saying, "Oh, whoops, I got my cards mixed up." And they, you know, said the quotes back and attributed them to Trump. And you saw the supporter go, "Oh," and start to justify them and everything because they thought they got a do over. And, you know, that team sports mentality doesn't really get to the heart of some of the things that are real dangerous. And I think there's a disconnect between how, I hate generalizing like this, but the average American voter views the political parties and how the elections are going in the broader context of what's actually legitimately at stake in this election. It feels almost like, oh, we already had Trump, nothing nothing went completely off the rails, even though, you know, I mean, it did. It was horrifying. We watched, you know, January 6th, we had an entire year almost of, you know, political violence, you know, with militia forces and things in different cities around the country. And they, especially here in my hometown of Los Angeles, I mean, we were, you know, inundated by giant trucks with Proud Boys and, you know, AK-47s or AR-15s or whatever hanging off the back. And it was a really scary kind of weird time. They tried to run Biden's campaign bus off the road. I mean, people seem to forget how scary that got and how scary it could get if the far right actors get into power. And I think people are missing a little bit of the historical context also between what conservative Republican, I don't know, norms and decorum were 20, 25 years ago versus how far it's been dragged to this very dangerous sort of fascist place. So I think examining the online discourse is very important.
Yeah, there was a saying fairly common in the Washington, D.C. public policy scene that politics is not really about policy, that we talk about, you know, there's some people want taxes to be this level and other people want taxes to be that level, or they disagree about the proper way to fund healthcare in this country. And that's the way that those of us who do this for a living talk. That's the way that journalists talk. That's the way it gets discussed on the news. But I think politics is, for most people, ultimately about two things. It's about which group they see themselves as belonging to. So it's cultural, affinity-based, and it's psychological. It's, do you have a personality type that leads you to enjoy a dynamic, diverse, multicultural, constantly evolving society? Or do you prefer tradition and things being the way, you know, that I know that next year is going to look the same as it did this year in terms of the culture and the tastes, the preferences and so on, that the world looks like I remember it when I was growing up. I know everybody in my town and that really doesn't change. And certainly there's no one showing up who, you know, speaks a language that I don't understand and so on. And I think along those two axes, that's where most people are. And that explains the thing you opened with of attributing certain policies or statements to one guy and then saying, nope, it was really the other guy. You know, we got when Trump came in, we had a whole lot of people flip their policy views. The right had usually been the group that was in favor of free trade, and the Democrats were the ones who wanted protectionism in order to protect the working class, who they saw as their constituency. That switched. And it, because Trump wanted to war with China and has a weird view of like a zero sum. Trump is fundamentally a zero sum guy. Like in order for one person to win, someone else has to lose in his mind, versus a positive sum, which is like you and I can both do better by helping each other out. I think that's just like completely alien to his worldview. And everyone switched, or the right very much wanted to get rid of Obamacare under Obama, but then Trump didn't really have a problem with it, and so they changed their tune. And that doesn't make sense unless it's the case that there's something else going on, and that which policies you're interested in have less to do with, I think this policy will make the world better in this way, or I think that policy would be harmful in that way, and instead thinking, you know, being in favor of this policy is how I signal membership in a given political tribe. It's how I say I'm with these guys and against those guys. And the problem with that is that it means that basically the whole way we've been talking about politics is unhelpful. Because in the past, I could say to you, hey, we disagree about, you know, you want Medicare for all. Because you think that that will provide health care to like the most access at the lowest costs. And I think that, you know, robust health saving accounts and privatized medicine through competition will lower costs and increase access. But we can both agree that the goal is we want low costs and high access for everybody. What we disagree with is just which of these mechanisms will produce those results. But if it's about personality, and it's about belonging to a certain group. And those groups are defined often in a negative way, in the sense that I'm with you because I'm not one of those guys. And both of us are not, we don't look like that group of people over there. Then those kinds of arguments drop away. They can't find any purchase because it doesn't really matter what it's going to do to the world. It's more about just, I want to stick it to the people over there. I want to punish the people I don't like. I want to vote for a guy who's going to represent my grievances against a world that's wronged me. And that puts us in this awfully tough space because it's not clear how to affect positive change in an environment that looks like that.
Mm-hmm. There's also a little bit of an element of, I've heard it described as ecstasy, almost like a religious type of fervor where certain people will get swept up in the permissive, you know, inclusion of being within the group. And you saw this kind of dynamic playing out on January 6th, where, you know, a lot of these behaviors that are peculiar, if you looked at what was normal in the U.S., maybe even just 15 years ago, these displays, these bombastic, you know, kinds of way of being, the rhetoric being heightened, everything like that. This idea that, you know, if I fit into one of these groups or whatever, I can indulge my desires in a certain way. And what I've seen from the center and center left, maybe not so much the far left, you know, people debate whether that exists. It exists, in my opinion. You see in the middle and the in the center and center left, you see a little bit more of this sense of restraint on decorum, things that we have. There's certain social rules and things. And then you see, you know, on the right and the far right, this sort of erosion of that. Like, it, you know, it's almost like in anything goes. You look at a Trump rally and, you know, it's like the most raucous kind of heavy metal concert you can go to. And I think that environment of perceived freedom, in a sense, not maybe in the political sense that we're thinking of, but more in like the personal, you know, kind of sense that you would get, like, you know, tailgating at a KISS concert, is attractive to people. And I think that's completely sociological.
The economist Tyler Cowen has a phrase that he, mood affiliation. That is his idea that often when we're picking the people we're going to associate with intellectually, politically, and so on, there's part of that obviously is like we have a shared sense of values, we accept the same arguments and so on, but that a big part of it too is this person, in terms of their mood and their style, their way of going about things, similar to me or not? And I want to be so I could be a Republican in Washington, D.C. and feel more comfortable hanging out with the Democrats who come from a similar background to me and are, you know, have the same sort of what we might call like elite tastes and preferences, than I would be among people who share more of my political viewpoints but come from different parts of the country where the culture is fundamentally different. And I think that's partly what you're talking about. I think the other thing that happened is there's this open question of, did Trump essentially, did he create his base? So did he convince a lot of Americans to change their views to look more Trumpy? And that's how the Republican Party changed? Or did he discover his base? Had this always been there? It just hadn't been organized, vocal, powerful, etc. And I think it's relatively clear that it's the latter. I think a lot about, so I am 45 years old, and a majority of Americans did not say to pollsters that they were okay with or favored interracial marriage until I think I was in high school, which is somewhat shocking. That attitudes about the acceptance of gay identities and lifestyles is quite recent. And And we can look at these, we look at these graphs of acceptance of this stuff and that, you know, that goes higher and higher and higher. You can look at that as a sign of progress. Like people are in general becoming more accepting. But the other way to interpret it, and this is, I think, speaks to what you were getting at and speaks to something we discovered in the Trump years, is what's called social desirability bias, which is where, like, if in general the culture, like you feel like the people who are kind of in charge of the culture or influential are in favor of something such that it's like seen as unseemly or it's going to get you ostracized to express your opinion, then you'll lie to pollsters. You won't necessarily tell them the truth. And so if a pollster in the mid-90s says, like, are you in favor of interracial marriage? You might not be, but you might not want to tell them that because you know it's like a social faux pas to say that. And so I think that to some extent, those like graphs of progress were telling an overly optimistic story. And then in fact, a lot of that upward curve was people just increasingly saying, like, I don't feel comfortable expressing homophobic or racist views, which is itself a form of progress, right? Like if people are going to be racist, the world is better if they like feel bad about it and keep it to themselves than if they proudly express it in the public sphere. And one of the things that Trump did was he was so brash and uncouth by the standards of American politics at the time that he gave a lot of people who had been effectively keeping their views on the down low an excuse to let their freak flags fly, to be more open about it, because now the guy at the very top is also saying these things. And so I think a lot of what we witnessed over those 4 years and in the years since is America was nowhere near as progressive socially as we thought it was. There had not been as much progress from the way that America looked in rural Mississippi in the mid-60s, say, as we thought or as we liked to think. And what it took was a guy who was willing to say all the stuff that you didn't used to say in polite company for those people to say, okay, now I can be open about my radicalism, my hatred of this group or that group, my lack of full-throated support for our democratic and liberal institutions, and so on. That this was kind of a discovery of, it's not the real character of America, because these are still minority viewpoints, but a larger chunk of the character of America than we liked to think.
I tend to agree with that. I mean, just on an anecdotal personal level, my family, we were from the North. We were from, my mother was from the Connecticut, Boston area, you know, New England. And then my father's family was from New York City. And we ended up moving to Florida when I was still in grade school. We moved down there for work. And, you know, it was kind of a night and day sort of situation. And the things that I experienced during that time, of course, now living in California and, you know, having friends that have grown up here their entire lives, some of the things that I tell them, they think it's hyperbole. They think it's, you know, some kind of a misremembering or figment of my imagination where I tell them things like, no, in school, when we would learn about the Civil War, we would hear terms like war of Northern aggression, war between the states, things like that. It was taught in a very specific way. We spent weeks talking about the Northern carpetbaggers more than we spent about, you know, about Lincoln and, you know, Reconstruction and all that stuff in a positive way. So, you know, that, of course, continued on until I remember I was down there visiting in the early 2000s, and I was picking something up like at a Walmart, and I was at the cashier's thing, and they had a big display. I don't remember what the product was, but it was Michael Jordan. And, you know, this was like right in the heyday of Michael Jordan's like biggest celebrity, whatever. And I'm getting whatever I'm getting. The people in front of me in line are looking at the thing, and just there in public doing whatever, you're hearing the N-word. They're joking about watermelon, all this stuff. The cashier's laughing along with them. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, this is like 2000, 2001. And so I was not shocked by this discovery, you know, of this sentiment by a large portion of Americans, but I think I am a little bit more shocked by how many people didn't realize it. And I think it took a lot of people by surprise. But getting into that post that you'd made, I think this all feeds into a portion of this argument about the expertise and tribalism and how we conduct this discourse. The thing that I saw, which I think you expanded into an article, was about how people, and I'm going to paraphrase, so I apologize, but how people who don't have a certain level of expertise are kind of thrust into a social situation on social media with people that do have expertise, but they have this like sort of psychological sunk cost in defending a bad argument, and it just unravels under that. And I think that kind of has a lot to say about the psychology of how we interact with each other right now.
Yeah, there's a lot of things going on that I contribute to this relatively common phenomena that I identified in that short essay. The first, I think, is grounded in the changing technological landscape of communication and commentary. So, you know, obviously, 50 years ago, most people did not have a platform. So unless you had a lot of money to publish your own magazine, or you were somehow famous or important enough to get on television, or you just wanted to mimeograph your underground zine for your friends, you couldn't give your opinion on things in a way that went outside of your immediate social circle. That changed with blogging and then social media, and that coupled with a generally politicized climate. So I think one of the, you know, I am very much in favor of dramatically limiting the scope of government, the things that it gets involved in. And one of the reasons is because the more that is determined politically, the more reason we have to think politics is really important and to fight about it. Because like if it's a decision that was determined entirely on an individual basis, you might disagree with me and you might do your thing and I might do my thing. But if we throw it into the political sphere and the politics is going to decide it, now if you get your way, I'm not going to get mine. And so it would become zero sum. And so now I necessarily have to view you in an adversarial way that I did not before, even if before maybe I just thought you were like a weirdo and I didn't want anything to do with you, you know. And so people are more invested in politics and political conversations than they used to be. And so those two things together, I think, encourages a culture of commentary where everybody feels like they need to have an opinion about everything and not just have it, but express it publicly. This is, you know, an example of this is fandom online is incredibly toxic. And say like YA novel and fiction fandom is just like a cesspool of hatred and vitriol. It's awful. And I think part of the reason that as bad as it is because doing thoughtful media criticism is really challenging. It takes a large body of knowledge. It takes a lot of thought, a lot of intellectual ability to be like a good media critic. But if you don't have that, because most people don't, they haven't developed that level of expertise, then the easiest way to do commentary is just like point at things and say that's problematic, or point at things and say that bugs me. And so you get this very kind of thin and conflict-driven sort of commentary because people feel obligated to take a stand on different issues and then to dig in on them because you get attention for digging in. You get attention for taking the outsider's opinion. And so when it comes to kind of the intellectuals, and part of that essay I wrote was prompted by Brett Weinstein, who is a professor of evolutionary biology, who ended up kind of in the intellectual dark web because he got, I don't think we were using the term then, but kind of canceled at his university. And to interject,
most recently in the news for promoting a long debunked conspiracy theory about HIV and AIDS being linked to party drugs.
Yes, and promoting it on Alex Jones's show on InfoWars.
Or Joe Rogan, I believe. Was it InfoWars or was it Joe?
I think he went on InfoWars to talk about it as well. And that was what kind of prompted this, because here's a guy who, you don't become a professor of evolutionary biology by being an idiot. You know, like he got a PhD. He must be a relatively smart guy. He has an area of expertise, and now he has watched over the years drifted in this direction where he's making pronouncements on things far outside of it, and they're just nonsense. Like, they're transparently nonsense. Like, a moment of reflection ought to show that, like, wait a second, this conspiracy theory is probably not true. So what's going on there? And my argument is that, first, people who have a high degree of intellectual expertise in one area tend to range outside of it. They tend to have an overly optimistic view of how much they know about other fields. I once went to a small private dinner with a guy who had recently won the Nobel Prize for a narrow area in economics and had written a book about topics outside of economics. And during the presentation, it quickly became clear he had no idea what he was talking about outside of it. He just had, like, deeply misunderstood basic facts about the topic that he was now writing on. But because he had a Nobel Prize, he's the guy with a Nobel Prize. And so he is a super smart guy who can talk about anything. So I think there's that. We overestimate. When you're an intellectual, you think you're an intellectual broadly as opposed to narrowly. And then you tend to, when this is in a politicized environment, you tend to map out the tribes. And so Brett Weinstein had seen himself as basically wronged by kind of the mainstream left, as he viewed it. And the intellectual dark web is, they like to present themselves as independent thinkers, but really what they are is kind of right-wing thinkers who just don't like the left. They very rarely are critiquing dumb views on the right. And so you begin to identify as, like, these views. So let's say, like, climate change, I think, is a good example of this, that, like, the mainstream people who politically I don't like all think that climate change is not just happening, but is, like, catastrophic. And they're, maybe they're using that, like, the policies that they think flow from that, I think, are bad. And so I don't like them. And so here's some, like, here's a heterodox position on climate change, that it's either not going to be bad, or, you know, the more extreme version, like, it's not happening at all. I'm going to, like, stake that out. And then I get criticized. Yeah. I mean, if you're prominent enough, like, if you're a prominent enough intellectual and you stake out a heterodox position, you're going to get pushback from the more orthodox people. And they're often going to have fairly persuasive, powerful arguments, because they also are experts. And in a lot of, it's not always the case that the consensus is right. Like, that's a pretty dangerous view to hold. But if there is, if a large body of experts believe this, that's at least a sign that, like, there's something there. It's not just probably total nonsense, right? And so you get this harsh criticism, people pushing back really hard on your arguments. And the way that you respond to that, because it's a politicized environment, these aren't just, like, other peers who, you know, it's not the kind of, like, idealized model of science of you put out your idea and then the other scientists push back on it or show counter evidence and then you show counter evidence and everybody's just, like, in this shared project of trying to approach the truth. But rather, these guys are the other political tribe from me, and they're pushing back hard on me. And so the correct way to interpret that is, like, if they're pushing back hard, I might not accept their arguments, but I should at least, like, take them seriously and try to figure out, like, why they think I'm wrong. And maybe I am wrong, but if I'm not, what they're getting wrong, etc. But instead, what you do is you get to thinking, oh, I've really upset them. Like, they've responded strongly. And why would they respond strongly to my thing, my position that is, in my mind, undermining a key pillar of their political worldview? Well, it must be because they feel threatened by it. It must be because, like, I have found a truth they don't want you to know. Because if they know that if you know, then their politics starts looking less solid than it did before. Mm-hmm. And so the pushback is not evidence that maybe you got something wrong, but is instead evidence that you probably got something right, that your argument is actually like more powerful than they want to admit. Otherwise, they would just be ignoring you. And if you get to thinking that way, then you're like, oh, I have discovered something. And so now I'm going to double down on it. I'm going to only really listen to the other people who also think I have discovered something, because they're probably part of my political tribe, and they're the ones who are equally threatening to the guys that I don't like. And any counter arguments get viewed in this light, that they are evidence of political opinions versus evidence of intellectual or epistemic differences. And I think once you get into that loop of just doubling down and doubling down and doubling down, it becomes very easy to then just keep staking out further heterodox opinions, you know, like, oh, well, maybe this other thing. So my views on gender, on evolution and gender roles are heterodox and got this attention. But I also heard this thing about the origins of AIDS, and that seems to also upset the same people. So maybe there's something to that. And my insular community is also buying into it. And the result is that you get these people who are like, again, very smart people. They're often very accomplished in their narrow field of expertise, just saying the most nonsense things as if they're like profound insights. And to the rest of us, we can see through this. We can just be like, this guy's clearly nuts. Like, what is going on? But to them, it feels like winning. Like everything that we see as evidence that they are, that something's gone wrong, they see as evidence that they're winning.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there's also an element to this where, are you familiar with the phenomenon of the cargo cult? You know that term?
Yes.
So for the audience, if you're not familiar, cargo cult, it's sort of this theory that evolved mostly out of World War II, where, you know, in the Pacific, they'd be dropping supplies and different things, and uncontacted peoples and whatever would start to perform rituals and sort of, you know, take on this performative stance, almost very religious, narrow niche thing to try to keep the airplanes coming and supplies dropping and stuff like that. So it's an interesting topic. People, you know, go and search it out. But I think there's also a little bit to this, because I was watching Gamergate evolve back in, I don't know, 2013, something like that. And what I was seeing happen, like the first couple of weeks, right when it started, and I wasn't a gamer, I was just very aware because I was keeping an eye on Breitbart and other stuff like that. And what I would see happen is, you know, they would come out with these arguments, the people who were proponents of Gamergate and the conspiracy theories around it. And then you would see these online arguments in Twitter, like, well, that's not true, or this is debunked by this and that and the other thing. And then you would see exactly what you talked about. One of these heterodox views, I think there was a professor, I forgot her name, and she jumped in there. They started calling her like base professor, base mother, stuff like that. And she came in there and she had a credential. And you sit there and you go, that's kind of interesting, because a lot of these people, like if you scrolled their feed, had a very negative view of higher education. They thought it's a scam. They thought it's a conspiracy, whatever. But they see somebody, oh, well, that's a credential. So almost like they internalized the credential of this person. They internalized this heterodox view to say, well, you know, I believe this, and this person has, you know, some kind of a thing. In your case, you were talking about the Nobel Prize. In this case, it was a PhD. But they internalize it, and they use that almost as a way of crafting their own intellectual identity around that tribal way of viewing the topic. And I think that that's an interesting phenomenon to explore more deeply about the interplay between the intellectual dark web and the community that follows it and utilizes it.
One thing that speaks to is how much of politics, but a lot of what we have seen lately is status games.
Mm.
So Gamergate was ultimately about men who thought they had a domain, video games, in which they were at the top, right? Like, video games was something for guys. The best gamers were guys. These games were made by, you know, overwhelmingly men. It was like a male clubhouse. And then girls started showing up. There were girls playing video games, and there were girls making video games. And then those girls had the audacity to critique the gender presentations of these games, the way that these games played to misogynist tropes and so on. And so it wasn't just the kind of girls had shown up in this thing that used to just be for us guys, but the girls were also saying, and here's some problematic elements of this culture that you guys have. And this feels like, here's an area where I felt high status. And now there's people who aren't just of a group that I saw as lower status than me entering it and being treated or asking to be treated as equals, but also critiquing the way that I have been behaving within this sphere and saying maybe it's not as high status as it, you know, as it appeared to be, or the status, the relative status should be brought down, etc. And that plays out all over the place. You know, I mean, that like white grievance politics of, it used to be that as a white man, I was, you know, even if I didn't have a fancy college degree and a high powered job, just by the fact of being a white guy, I had a level of status in this country above immigrants, say, or people of color. There's a phenomenon called last place avoidance, where people will, you know, so like one of the examples of this, I think this is a really interesting phenomenon to watch happen, is some minimum wage and voting for or against minimum wage. And I think I, you know, as someone with political views that I hold, I think there are real problems with raising the minimum wage, because I think it prices a lot of low income or low skilled workers out and doesn't allow them to build the social capital to raise their wages. People overestimate how many people are actually earning minimum wage versus higher, et cetera. So there might be policy reasons to think raising the minimum wage, but most people aren't aware of that. And most, what was found is that people who were often least supportive of the minimum wage were the ones who were earning just above the minimum, because they knew there were people, I might be near the bottom, but there are people who are below me. I'm not in last place. If we raise the minimum wage, then now those people who are below me will be earning as much as me, and now I'm in last place. And I don't want that. I don't like that, because I need to know that I'm not at the bottom in terms of status. And that happens all over the place. So that's the turn, the kind of Andrew Tate style toxic masculinity, is a lot of this, of men feeling like women are rising in relative status compared to men, that the things, that the behaviors that they used to view as traditionally masculine that got them ahead no longer do, because our economy has shifted to valuing other sorts of skills and perspectives and values and behaviors. And so their relative status is lowering. And within these circles, so Gamergate, but also like the intellectual dark web, a lot of the people who ended up in the intellectual dark web, became major figures, were often people of either high or like modest status within their professions, who then something happened that knocked their status down. So they got accused of sexual misconduct, or they, in some other way, their status was knocked down, or they viewed other people as rising in relative status. And so they reacted strongly against it. And they often drift in this kind of right-wing direction. And so part of it is you get what we could think of as like audience capture. So you were high status, you got knocked down, you ended up in this little community where you're now talking about how maybe vaccines do cause autism, or maybe excess COVID deaths are actually caused by side effects of vaccines or whatever. And all those people who you used to be high status among, they still hate you and they're telling you you're wrong, but you found this new group that values your opinion, especially, as you mentioned, the credentialed person. And I agree, there's this tension of like, we don't trust the eggheads, but this guy has a PhD and he's on our side, so we're going to play up the fact that there's a PhD on our side. but you found a new group of people who give you high status, at least among that small community, and that feels awfully good. You want that. You like all of us want to feel valued by other people. We like praise. We like being high status. And so you end up hanging out in that community and then getting captured by it. That now your incentive is, oh, well, that community praised me when I pushed back on gender identity issues. But it looks like they'll also praise me if I talk about the dangers of immigrants taking over the country, or I criticize certain aspects of like medical science or whatever it happens to be. And you start embracing those things too, because it just gives you more of the praise you want and more of the kind of thing that ultimately, I mean, was like in the beginning was the trigger of how you ended up in this direction to begin with.
I think there's maybe an interplay here between the algorithm of different social networks and how we have to satisfy it that is a component we haven't analyzed yet. So let's say that you mentioned gender criticism or something like that. So let's use maybe like Jordan Peterson, because I think he fits the mold of kind of what you're talking about. So he was a modestly successful academic, you know, nothing earth-shaking, felt very threatened by some policies in Canada that were completely different than what he contextualized them as, but he contextualized them and his own personal crusade against them in a way that really, really resonated with this intellectual dark web group, audience, whatever you want to call it. And he followed almost every step that you brought up. He's been kind of elevated to this, you know, position that he might even actually within that parallel group have a much, much, much higher profile than he could have ever achieved in the original group. So he sort of status jumped in a way. It was almost, you know, I can be in the middle over here, or I can be a big fish in a small pond over here. And it's very clear which direction he chose. But collecting what you said earlier about people maybe overestimating their own level of expertise because they have a level of expertise in one area. Now you get into this thing about the algorithm. You get into this thing about social media, because a lot of these online intellectual, it's called the intellectual dark web for a reason, because these communities are built digitally, virtually. And that is driven by a certain amount of social media norms and surfacing and engagement. And that means that you need to have content. I've often described the social media platforms as almost like a coal engine, right? Like where you just have to keep shoveling stuff in to be able to keep this thing moving forward. And back when we were young adults, you know, like the late 90s, early 2000s, that was still a time period where somebody who was a prominent figure with an intellectual kind of background, academic or, you know, public intellectual, whatever, essayist, you could write a book. And that cycle might be like a 3-year-ish cycle where you write this thing, you get it out, you do speaking engagements, you tour universities, you know, get some niche radio, maybe you know, do a couple of editorial articles and some publications around it. But, you know, you're essentially, you know, dining out on the concepts of that book for, you know, 3-4 years while you're working on whatever that follow-up is. I think people run out of stuff to say. So you end up there, it's like Jordan Peterson can only talk about, oh, I don't like pronouns so much, until he just runs out of things to say. And I think that's where that creep sort of starts to begin. It's like, oh, well, you know, I also know a lot about this, so I'm going to say, I don't know about quite as much about this, but I'm going to say. And so you start going down the checklist until you're really, really, really far outside of that original level of expertise. And you still are like, well, I'm getting the same reactions, so obviously I must be right. So I think it becomes a feedback loop of a sort.
Yeah. And as you were saying that, the connection between the mechanisms by which this kind of pathway into nonsense reinforces itself within like genuine interpersonal communities mirroring the kind of the incentives that the algorithm creates, I had not thought of, but I think that's a really interesting, like, these are much more similar than they might appear at first. But I think you're right. And I think it's made, it works in a couple of ways. First, it is really easy. It's being someone who has, you know, part of my job was writing for a lot of years. Tweeting is a lot easier than writing. And it's yeah. awfully, like, the desire to convince yourself that spending an hour posting away on Twitter, you have accomplished just as much as if you put an hour into editing that essay you're avoiding editing, is very, very strong. It's just fun because it is the instant feedback. It's a kind of writing that is that often like kind of dry and sarcastic humor that plays well on social media is itself just, it's a fun way to write. And so there's all of that. And then I also think that there's an angle of, there's the term parasocial relationships, which is where, you know, I mean, I think, so you and I are recording a podcast right now. We're both podcasters. One of the things that I think makes podcasting as powerful a medium as it is compared to if you and I had just published blog posts about these same topics is right now people are hearing me speaking directly into their ears. And it's a very like intimate connection. And if we both have good microphone setup, so there's like a warmth to the voice and then you listen to someone for years and years and years. And even if you've never had, they don't know you exist. You've never had an interaction with them, but you feel like you know them in a way that doesn't come through, say, in other mediums. And that happens very much in social media too, where you know, I reply back to some random person who replies to me on social media. And for me, it feels like just reply, like replying to one of many, many replies that I might get. This has changed since I switched to Reds and have a smaller follower base than I had when I deleted my Twitter account, but which is actually, it's kind of nice. But like, but from the other person's perspective, it's like, oh, this big name has like contacted me and paid attention to me. And it feels like you've established a connection in this way that is parasocial. It's not a real social connection, but it feels that way. And I think that the whole medium encourages us. And so when you are this person who has, yeah, like as you said, Jordan Peterson was this kind of mid-tier academic who'd written one book that was liked by some people, largely ignored by most people. This was, I think it was Maps of Meaning, his Jungian psychology stuff. But you want to keep that attention stream go. Every author has had that, like, I've been writing this book and the book's been, it's been published and it's got a publication date and my editor is paying a lot of attention to me and we're going to do this promotion. And then it happens and the book is out and 3 months later, you just, it's almost like a postpartum depression or something. It's, you know, like I expected that kind of high to continue and it didn't. And the social media, if you built that community around, you can kind of keep that going and you can constantly like reconnect and re-get that praise and feel like you're a really big deal. Even if you're only a big deal in this weird little corner of Twitter, you still have 10 or 20 or 30 or 50,000 people following you and responding to everything that you say. And you're right, it does encourage you to just keep going and to listen to the praise and not listen to the people who might be saying, hey, you've ventured outside your wheelhouse. What you just said is like not actually correct, or I think you're going in the wrong direction, or you're starting to make a fool out of yourself. You know, because Jordan Peterson now is just a lunatic. I mean, he was tweeting last week, was it, about at the AP for reporting on street parking and
the lower death rates and he says the woke death is coming for you, AP. I mean, yeah. What does that mean?
Like, it doesn't mean anything. It's like nonsense. It's total nonsense. And
I reposted that on one of my social accounts. I still actually have a very engaged footprint on Facebook. And I reached a couple million people every month on that platform. So I get a lot of traction. And when I put that up, you know, people were coming in, they're like, well, you just don't understand it. You just haven't decrypted the genius of Jordan Peterson. They weren't even saying that sarcastically. So he still has a good sway over a certain amount of people, even though I think he's largely been diminished in the legitimate political discourse over the last couple of years.
Yes, he definitely has dropped, but as long as he has that hardcore mm-hmm. who are telling him he still is the most important guy in their lives, he's going to keep doing it.
It's kind of interesting the way that they build these communities, but I also think that at least a portion of that engagement that is attributed to people like Jordan Peterson and Brett Weinstein and you know, even back in the Gamergate era, and you still see some of these Gamergate figures sort of bubbling up to the surface. Like, I think Elon Musk was having those conversations with the user called Cat Turd, you know, on Twitter X as recently as a couple of months ago, and, you know, sort of elevating that person up. And that's a Gamergate era, you know, kind of holdover. So these people do still have a level of prominence. And I think a lot of observers, people who are wading into those waters, can see this engagement as a way of almost like a fame lottery. Like if I say the right thing at the right time to the right person, maybe I can start to siphon off some of that engagement. I can elevate myself socially within this group as well. And I think some of the more inflammatory things that end up pushing that feedback loop might also be attributed to that attention-seeking behavior, because they see the rewards that are given to people. You see, like, during the Trump term, people like Diamond and Silk and some of these other people that kind of come in from the periphery and get elevated. And I think that incentivizes some of these takes and engagement for people who are looking to jockey status or, you know, trying to enter a media career of some sort.
It's interesting because one of the differences, so I guess it's interesting in the sense that how the platform structure themselves can play into this in ways that aren't necessarily like obvious up front. And so one of the things that is different about, say, Blue Sky and Threads than Twitter is Twitter, especially like in its chronological feed, is if I follow you, I will see all of your posts and retweets and so on. And if I follow you and someone else, then if the two of you interact with each other, I'll see that. I'll see your reply to someone if I also follow that person. But on Blue Sky and Threads, and I think part of this was just they're trying to juice engagement numbers by filling your feed with more stuff, a reply functioned as a retweet. So if you mm-hmm. follow me and you reply to me, even if your followers don't follow me, it will show up. Your reply will show up in the feed along with my post that you're replying to.
I've noticed that as well.
And the incentive then is one way for me to build an audience is to effectively get big accounts to reply to me, because even if they wouldn't have retweeted me, they're just that reply functions as one. And so saying things that are going to get a response from that big account, even if it's negative, it's critical, is going to bring a ton of attention to me in a way that I could not have gotten before. And so it incentivizes the kind, like, engaging with other people and particularly bigger accounts in a way that is intended to provoke a response, which is not necessarily the kind of engagement that you want, especially because we've been kind of trained that you can't just, like, if someone is wrong on the internet, you can't leave it alone. And so even if you're a big account and someone says something stupid in the replies, the urge to push back and say, no, you're wrong, is very, very strong. But in doing that, you're now elevating them in a way that was not the case with an earlier generation of social media.
I wonder what we do about that, though. I mean, we've kind of diagnosed a couple of issues, and I think you're right on the money on most of it, if not all of it. And it kind of leads to the next thing. It's kind of like, what does the average person do to regulate their own behavior or engagement? Or is this just a part of human nature and we've just identified it and we move on? Is there an action item to do here?
It's tough. I mean, one thing you could do is just say, I'm not going to participate in these platforms at all. You know, I mean, for most of human history, most people lived their entire lives contentedly without ever posting on Twitter, and it was fine. And we could go back to that, you know, similar to the way that you could say, like, my phone is super addictive. I could just give up my phone. I could get rid of it. I could get a dumb phone and I could just read paperbacks, you know. But there's a lot of advantages to being in these systems. Having a smartphone has its advantages. Being on social media and being able to have, because we talked about, like, there's parasocial relationships, but there's also, I think, all of us who have been on social media long enough have experiences of developing genuine friendships, like real human connections. There's someone you would never have known otherwise, and now this person is, like, not just someone you kind of interact with every now and then, but, like, a legitimately important part of your life. And that's wonderful. And that, and the ability to break down, you know, you can be, it used to be if you were the one gay kid in the small rural community, you felt really lonely until you were old enough to go somewhere else. But now you can find a community of people who are the other gay kids in small communities or share your interests and don't really care about your sexual identity. Like, that is incredibly powerful and important and something, like, we should praise about these platforms. And so I don't think that just giving it up is the right thing to do. I think probably the best thing that most people can do is just try to be really mindful of their own behaviors and motivations on these platforms. And so to think, is following these kinds of people, when I am engaging with them, when I'm reading this stuff, when I'm replying to it, when I'm interacting with other people in their replies, am I feeling contented doing so? Or am I feeling, you know, am I feeling stress levels rising? Am I feeling like that tightness in my chest that, you know, like, that feels like it can feel like really engaging, but to recognize that and then say, okay, I'm not actually benefiting from this. Or to recognize, like, this is where I have an area of expertise and I have a lot to say in that area of expertise, but I don't need to talk outside of it. There are other ways to get attention. There are other ways to get praise. And so, yeah, it's about engaging, not just on social media, but in kind of this whole, like, political cultural sphere in a way that is more mindful, where you're paying attention to what it's doing to you, what you are doing to other people. Like, if the things I'm saying, are they probably, you know, it's one thing to critique someone's ideas and to have, like, a debate where both people come out of it saying, I've learned something. But most of the time, that's not what we're doing. You know, we're just attacking for the sake of attacking or scoring points or getting attention. And so being aware of, like, there's another person on the other side of this who is feeling the impact of what I'm doing, and how can I be less harmful to myself and to them? But it's challenging because everything about our environment, about these platforms, is designed to discourage us from doing exactly that. They're addictive, they're fast moving, we get rewarded for behaving badly. And so you have to put a hell of a lot of effort into it. But I think you can just, like, say, okay, I'm about to send this thing. Is this the kind of person I want to be? Is this the kind of interaction I want to have with others? Are the people that I'm following, are they actually the kind of people that I want to associate with, that I want to make part of my life? And just really pay attention and recognize that everything you're getting from it, that you think you're getting from it, the engagement, the attention, and so on, like, you can get still in healthier ways.
I wish we had more time to get into this, because it opens up so many questions about media literacy and misinformation and propaganda and motives. It's a whole, you know, field of thought. And I know that you cover a lot of this in your writing and your podcasts and everything like that. So where can people who are listening right now find everything that you're involved in?
Two places. One is go to AaronRossPowell.com, and that's where you'll find my writings and my Reimagining Liberty podcast. The other one is I host shows and occasionally write for The Unpopulist, which is an online journal about the rise of the populist right and critiquing those ideas. And that's at theunpopulist.net.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Aaron. This was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Visit phantomastronaut.com for all of the different ways that you can help us to continue to create. And I will see you out there.